Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and video show which brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. If you're new to the channel, please subscribe so you won't miss a new episode. I'm your host, Fritz Bussemaker, and I'm delighted and privileged to have a conversation with Fred Werner. Fred, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Fritz, and thanks for having me. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Well, it's very much mutual, Fred. And let me introduce you to the audience. You are the head of strategic engagement at the ITU, executive producer of the AI for Good Summit. You have a strong and long background in telecoms and a native from Belgium, but you're living in Geneva at the moment.
That's correct. Now,
I am assuming that a large part of the audience just heard me say a lot of acronyms, which they don't have a clue what that means. And I see it in your background, ITU, AI for Good, but let's explore that. First of all, what is the ITU?
Yeah, so the ITU is the United Nations Specialized Agency for Information and Communication Technologies. And basically, we do three things. We allocate and harmonize radio spectrum. We also allocate satellite orbits. We develop international technical standards on telecommunications and information communication technologies. For example, you and I would not be able to have this video call were it not for ITU standards, dealing with things like video compression, international numbering resources, fiber, transport, home and access connectivity technologies. So all of these things that enable technologies to interconnect and interoperate across borders are developed at ITU. Of course, that's done in collaboration with other standards organizations like ISO and IEC. And last but not least, we do capacity building, helping developing countries to bring up their ICT infrastructure to help basically connect the world so that they can benefit from the benefits of technology. And one thing that's unique about ITU is we're the only UN agency that has both a public and private membership model. So we have, of course, 193 member states as members, but we also have 900 technology companies, telecom companies, software companies, infrastructure companies as members, and also 150 academic institutions. So it's really a combination of member states, industry, and academia that's driving all of these technical standards development.
That's huge. And I think it's also good to be aware that there is this organization called ITU bringing the world together, which indeed makes it possible that you and I talk and we can actually share this with people around the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, how do you become an employee of the ITU? Because for most, that might not be a career path they would have considered. How did you do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so I've been at ITU for just over 6 years now. But before that, I was living in Belgium, in Brussels, and I was always involved in association management and membership-based organizations. So first part of my career was actually in standards. So that actually has a natural link to what ITU does. And the second part of my career was at an organization called ETIS, which basically brought together the CIOs and CTOs of the European telecom operators to basically share knowledge and best practices around implementing IT and ITCT solutions in telecom operators. So for example, on topics like cybersecurity or business intelligence or electronic billing, procurement, IT governance, basically anything you need to know to successfully deploy IT in telecommunications. And I'd been there for about 12 years and going through different roles, ending up in a leadership role. And at one point I thought, okay, how do I go from European level to global level? And ITU seemed to be the next logical step, being a global organization dealing with telecommunications as such. But I think also maybe backtracking a bit, a lot of people who would like to work at the UN want to work at the UN for the sake of working at the UN. And maybe they just apply to random agencies because they just want to work at the UN. My primary motivation was telecommunications. So first and foremost, I applied to ITU because I wanted to work in global telecommunications. And then, of course, the fact that I'd always been in international membership organizations. I have a very international background myself. So I was born in Belgium. After about 2 months, I moved to Senegal, then to Ivory Coast, then to Guinea, then to the UK, then to the Philippines, then to Turkey, then to Austria and Hungary, all before graduating from high school. So you could say I was kind of put in the deep end when it came to international
Wow.
relations. So it kind of came as a natural fit, where I think in the back of my mind, I always thought that the UN would be a good place. But first and foremost, it was telecommunications that brought me to ITU.
But you made an interesting remark. A couple of follow-on questions. First of all, you went because of the telco. It gave you an opportunity to deal with telco on a global level, but there are a lot of people who then go to UN agency because they want to work for UN agency. If you look at the ITU, what's the mix? People with that passion for telecommunications or passion for working for a UN agency?
It's interesting. I would say, I mean, primarily it's a technical body, right? We develop standards, we do capacity building, we regulate spectrum. The work is largely technical, but we are a UN agency, and the basically our lighthouse, if you will, is the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, and that guides everything we do. And of course, the fact that we have to collaborate with 40 or so other UN agencies, there's a lot of interagency coordination happening at the UN level. Also, our development work, helping developing countries to bring up their ICT infrastructure, is very much UN focused in the sense of capacity building and development and basically helping people. So I would say the mix is almost 50-50. But of course, without the underlying technical activities, if you will, that drives all of our main activities.
So it's 50-50, and you do need both. You need to connect, you need the support, and you need to have the knowledge. And actually, that's a good segue to also what's back on your screen, the AI for good. Now, I have to share this with the audience. That's also the reason why we got connected, the AI for good. So I'm quite honored to have a still have a small role in the organization of that event. But
I would say a
maybe
big role or a very useful, helpful role.
Thank you so much. For the audience, what's AI for good?
So AI for Good was built on the premise that we have now less than 8 years to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. And AI holds great promise to advance many of those goals and targets. So if you're looking at AI to reduce hunger, to end poverty, to increase education, to increase gender equity and balance, but also looking at high-tech solutions within smart cities, autonomous driving, e-health, the potential is definitely there. And what's interesting is we see interesting use cases coming across our desk all the time. And they did a recent mapping in the scientific journal Nature Communications, where something like 130 or so of the targets could be positively impacted by the SDGs, but something like 55 or so could be negatively impacted by the SDGs. So some of the positive use cases we see would be, for example, using a mobile phone to scan a lesion on your skin, and it would tell you if maybe it's cancerous or not, or what kind of a skin disorder you have. Or using a mobile phone to scan your eyeball and detect heart disease or glaucoma or different diseases. Likewise, we see lots of interesting applications combining using satellite imagery combined with big data, IoT, and social media data to, for example, forecast and map poverty or maybe try and predict and mitigate natural disasters. Of course, in the context of autonomous driving, there's lots of interesting use cases for increasing safety. So the use cases are there. And we see them every day, which is probably the most interesting part of my job. But one thing is, how do you know, first of all, how do you know what's good? And also, how do you know that an application would work equally well on men and women, on people of different ages, people of different skin colors? Would this application work well in a developing country or in a low resource setting? And basically, these are things that not occur naturally to startups, to big tech in a very fast-paced moving environment. But these are things that do occur naturally and are discussed at AI for Good. So there's great value in basically looking at these solutions with the lens of the Sustainable Development Goals and making sure that the benefits are equally distributed and can benefit all. So an app that could work well in Silicon Valley or in a high-tech lab in Europe or maybe in Shenzhen, Does that work equally well across 50 or so African countries with all the political, economical, environmental, societal challenges that involves? So basically connecting what we call AI innovators with problem owners to create a common framework of understanding is key to basically scaling AI for good so that it can basically chart a beneficial course for humankind.
Yeah. Now, you just gave us an abundance of examples, but that's not always been the case, because I remember 2016, 17, we had a completely different situation.
That's true. I think looking back, I mean, one of the things that spurred the creation of AI for Good was all of the hype and media buzz that was happening at the time. So you may remember AI was definitely the buzzword of the year in the media. You know, you often have the image of the Terminator associated with AI. Is it going to end all jobs, make us irrelevant? Will it be the end of the world? Or on the flip side, will it create this paradise where all our needs are met and we can paint all day long? So those were the two extremes. But the fact was that there are many practical applications of AI that do exist or that were about to exist shortly. And our focus was, really, instead of being a talk shop, let's be action oriented and let's be practical and let's identify practical applications of AI that exist today to advance the sustainable development goals. And there's definitely a sense of urgency among our community in the sense that a high potential solution that you see today might take 2 or 3 years to develop. It might take two or three more years to deploy and scale. And then you might have 2 or 3 more years where you start to see some kind of measurable impact, beneficial impact on the SDGs. And that brings us right up to 2030. So there's no time to waste. And what we're looking at are things that exist now and that can be deployed and that can be used. And I think we've gone from the hype buzz phase to the decade of implementation, if you will, where AI is here, it exists, it's in half the apps on your phone, and you probably don't even know it. And these solutions are there to be used and to be used wisely, and hopefully AI for good can help to create a good pathway for that.
Yeah, because Fred, let me, because you've shared so much information now, there are a couple of questions I'd like to ask you. First of all, indeed, the statement, we have to realize in 2017, it was just a buzzword with limited use cases. So in just a couple of years, the application has exploded. So that's a given. But also you talked about the community. What is your community? Who's a member of that community?
Yeah, so first of all, AI for Good, we can't do this alone. That's why we have 40 UN sister agencies as partners. So that's virtually the entire UN system. And so ITU is, you could say, the organizer, but the 40 agencies are our partners. And they're helping to drive the programs, to bring the audience. They're there to learn, they're there to share expertise. And basically, when I use the term AI innovators and problem owners, you could say that the UN agencies are indeed problem owners because they have a very good understanding of the problems of the ground. But it doesn't stop there. So AI for Good, it's an open and free platform. It always has been. And we have, since we've gone virtual because of COVID, our audience has, we've reached over 200,000 people online from 183 countries. And these are, AI experts from industry, top experts from academia, people from NGOs, from civil society. We have media there, international organizations, and we also have the creatives, so artists, poets, musicians, athletes. So the AI experts themselves would say AI is too important to leave to the experts themselves. So one of our goals is to bring as many people to the table to share knowledge, experience, problem statements, expertise on how to use AI for good.
Okay, so does that also mean to the audience listening to this, what can they do? How can they get involved?
Well, like I said, since COVID, so it used to be a physical summit in Geneva that happened once a year in the spring. And once COVID hit, we turned into a new platform called the Neural Network. And basically what it is, it's an online matchmaking networking community platform where on top of all of the weekly programming that's happening, you can basically create a profile. You'll get actually AI-powered suggestions giving suggestions from over 6 years of content. There's also matchmaking, so which would match when I say connecting problem owners of AI innovators, the matchmaking is exactly designed around that. So for example, you might have data, I might need data. That would be a match. You might have open algorithms, I might need algorithms. That would be a match. I might have cloud storage, you need cloud compute power to run algorithms. That would be a match. Startups with funding. So the matchmaking function for me is something that was definitely missing while we were doing all the online sessions, but it's there as well. And of course, there's the weekly programming. So it's basically a virtual events platform. And we just launched it about a month ago, and already over 4,000 profiles have created profiles and are joining. So our challenge is to bring the 200,000 people who followed us online since COVID hit onto this platform and hopefully add a lot of benefits with the smart suggestions and the smart connection mechanism.
Now, if I then go back to your role, you just told me that you started to work for ITU because you have a passion for telecom and a background in telecom. But what you're now describing, which is a large part of your daily work, seems you're now in the area of connecting people. So it shifted. Are you happy with that shift? Is this something you want to do?
I think it's a natural shift. If you remember going back to my childhood story of living, I think, in 10 plus countries before I was 18, I was always in the business or in the hobby of connecting people, welcoming new people, but also being the new person myself, and then moving into membership association work and then into ITU. This whole idea of connecting people, sharing knowledge, creating a community, sharing best practices, for the benefit of whatever the topic of the day is. That's always been a natural, I guess, element of mine in what I do. And I really think this is the next layer. So going from physical event to virtual event, the connection mechanism, and also using AI as a tool to facilitate that connection is helping to create more opportunities, more sharing of knowledge, more connections, more projects. And I said before that, we're action oriented, and we're not doing this just for the sake of creating events and having a lot of people online. Everything we do is designed to basically create some kind of action outcome. And the main actions I think that have come out of the summit is what we call AI focus groups. So these are what I call the building blocks of AI for good. And these are pre-standardization efforts. And we created a number of initiatives, so AI and health with the World Health Organization. And they're basically creating a benchmarking framework for the testing and efficacy of AI for health algorithms, which is super important. I mean, imagine if you were a mayor or running a hospital and you're presented with hundreds of apps that are high potential. How do you know which one is good? How do you know they work equally well on men and women? How do they stack up against each other? So for drugs, drug development, there's the FDA and a very lengthy and expensive process for before something goes to market. But for these AI algorithms, they're popping up daily on the App Store, and there's no mechanism for evaluating if these are good or not. So that's the type of work that's taking place in the AI for Health group. And similar work is taking place across different topics. So we have the AI and autonomous driving focus group, which also is backed by an AI and road safety initiative. We have AI and environmental efficiency. We have AI and natural disaster management. We have AI, IoT, and digital agriculture, AI and machine learning. So these are all groups that are open, they're free, they're international. And for me, they're working on the building blocks that would get rid of the bottlenecks that would be needed to basically have interoperability and AI for good solutions at scale. So I would like to say the webinars are great, the neural network is great, all these things are great, but without the end goal of action, it's all for nothing. And for me, the real prize is those focus groups and activities that have come out of AI for good.
Hey, that's very good to hear. Actually, what's in the back of my mind struck what you said about your personal background, that before you turned 18, you saw all, you lived in the whole world. To some extent, that seems like a milestone, because it's interesting to see that you related that milestone, that experience, to what you're now doing in your career. So I was wondering, A, is that a milestone? And are there other milestones in your career said, hey, that actually formed my life, or that has influenced me?
It's funny you ask that because when you're a kid or a child, you don't know you don't know any different. You just think that's normal. I was living in Manila during the President Marcos revolution. I was living in Istanbul. I was in Cold War Hungary. I was in Salzburg. I was in some African countries. And at the time, it seemed completely normal. But as you get older and you tell your story, you see the look on people's faces, and they're like, maybe that's not so
Oh,
normal.
maybe you have to tell me, actually, what did your parents do that you were able to travel so much?
So they work for the airline industry.
Okay.
So you had Sabena, the national airline, back in the day. It doesn't exist anymore, but yeah, that's what the reason for all the travel.
That's okay. But that, so th that is a milestone. You're not aware it was a milestone, only in hindsight. Are there more milestones which you are consciously aware of, which say, hey, that actually helped me?
Yeah, I would say the next one is when I joined ETIS, so that's the telecommunication ICT organization. And something I took up a few years of my time there was, you may remember, and this was, I think, gosh, probably well over 10 years ago, cybersecurity was probably the buzzword of the day. So you had well before AI and big data and cloud, you had cybersecurity. And so one of my big activities there was basically creating a pan-European network of cybersecurity experts, starting with the chief information security officers at the telcos, down to their security experts, their cert experts, their SOC experts, their anti-spam experts, and basically creating almost like an AI for good type environment where they could share best practices and trusted exchange of knowledge. We set up a kind of an automated intelligence threat exchange platform where they could exchange cyber attacks in real time. And that was, I would say, a first experiment, more of an experiment, because it actually ex established that whole network. But really, was an interesting part of my career where I was able to apply all the lessons learned from that in ITU, building maybe this next network around AI for good.
It's going to be interesting to find out what's going to be the next network you're going to work on, because it seems that
Well,
that's something you're good at, and on the international, on a global level. Now, a couple of questions to end this great talk, Fred. Where do you normally draw your inspiration from?
that's a good question. I think from people, first and foremost, from connecting people. Part of my job is just meeting people from multiple countries, different backgrounds, different industries, and just hearing shared stories and trying to draw inspiration from that. Personally, I also have many personal interests, so I'm a musician, and I have three boys. I'm into many different sports as well, and I like to think of all these outside interests as kind of cross training for life. So some people might say, "Well, why do you spend so much time on music or these type of activities?" But I truly think that it creates different connections in the brain that can stimulate, creativity and but also free up space and capacity to try new things. So yeah, I think definitely drawing in inspiration from people, from my work, from learning, from always trying to explore what's next on the horizon. But also, it's not always all about work. And I think you can draw a lot of inspiration from your family, your friends, your hobbies, your experiences. So if I'm not, I'm always trying to break new boundaries professionally, and I think also on the personal side, trying to break new boundaries, whether it's music, playing drums, kite surfing, snowboarding, all of these activities. You definitely find inspiration trying to push those boundaries as well.
So, getting inspiration from pushing boundaries, basically, that's what I'm hearing. Now, a couple of final thoughts, Fred. All those experience, that inspiration, what has it taught you? What's the lessons you've learned, which you want to pass on to the audience?
Yeah, I mean, if I look back through my career, I think there's definitely been a shift in mindset, and no one really teaches you this, but you sort of learn it around, you sort of learn it along the way. And I think when you're younger, it's all about, or at least I was all about being independent. So if I work hard and I put in enough hours and I work harder than anyone else, I'll get more done and I'll be better. And And yes, I could get help, but it's easier to do it yourself, right? So that's sort of the young man mindset. But then you find out actually that it's more beneficial to be interdependent. So if you sacrifice a bit of those hours building relationships and actually accepting help and helping others and being more interconnected, that actually frees you up to do more. And ironically, you become more independent because you have more space. And then going from that, when you get into kind of a management role, then you're like, okay, fine, I have a team, I'm interdependent, I'm working with more people. And then you're kind of about outcomes, right? So you're like, well, how can I beat last year's target, or how can I do better or be more efficient? And it's more about outcomes. But then my latest mind shift has been going more from outcome-oriented to people-oriented, in the sense that if you let go of the hard outcomes and you put more and more energy on people, and then you're going from sort of independence to interdependence to management and management outcomes to maybe a kind of leadership role where it's all about people. And if you take care of the people, the outcomes will come. And then again, you can scale and exponentially do more and more. So I think that was a hard-learned lesson, and no one really teaches you that. I mean, I did an MBA, I did different programs, and you do different trainings, but it's something you kind of need to learn yourself. So whenever I have someone new on my team, I try and already shift their mindset and say, look, yes, you can be the hardest person, working person in the world, but everyone has 24 hours, and that's it. So that's only going to go so far. So get rid of that independent mindset.
So in your experience, you learned it the hard way almost on your own, but can you speed up the process or learn this earlier in your life? Is that your experience when you discuss this with the people in your team?
Yeah, I think it's, about finding a probably a mentor or someone who can explain it to you, or maybe explaining is not enough, but actually show it to you, because people really need to understand the benefit themselves. So the hardest part is probably letting go, because you have to let go of control to accept the wider possibility of what may come. And so, but yeah, that's it. And I learned this, I think, in the last few years, partly through some mentors and some coaches. But you also have to experience it to really implement it and actually live by it. So I definitely see the benefit of that now, but it's not something that happens overnight. I mean, this was something that happened over a couple of decades. And if someone could take something away from this, I would say, maybe if you let go of it, you can get more in the end. And going from interdependence to, oh, sorry, independence to interdependence and being people-oriented instead of outcome-oriented. For me, that has a lot more benefits long term.
That's a great takeaway to end this conversation with, Fred. I'm very happy that you were able to take time to spend some time with us to share your knowledge, your insights, to promote AI for good. And I know people can get involved. Just sign up for the AI for good from the ITU website, and I see the website's in the screen, so people will provide the link. And again, thank you so much for making your time. I really enjoy talking to you on this.
Well, it's an honor to be invited. So thank you, Fritz. And also thank you for all your tireless work. For those listening, Fritz is part of the AI for Good Outreach Committee. And we talked about networking a lot during this call. And I would say Fritz is a master networker himself, and I'm learning from him as well. So thanks for that, Fritz.
Thank you so much. We'll be in contact.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.